we're going to go ahead and call this session to order. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to address the board regarding any closed session items? Seeing none, we will adjourn to closed session. Okay, we're going to go ahead and call this meeting to order at 7 p.m. We will begin with the invocation from Ms. Poulos and the flag salute from Ms. Shoemaker. Everyone can please stand.
Please bow. Dear Lord, we want to thank you for having the opportunity to be advocates for the individuals in this district, and we ask that you guide us through this meeting so we can look at all of the things that need to be done for the staff, the students, the parents. We ask that you watch over the students as they're ending their summer break and preparing to come back to us. And bless all the teachers and staff that are getting ready to come back to school. And dear Lord, as Ms. Valentine starts her new adventure in life, we ask a special blessing on her, and we want to just have you spread our gratitude towards her for all she's done to this district and the advancement of our students. In his name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Please join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please. Here.
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 Okay. There is no new business to, there is no action to report from closed session. We have a presentation, but I don't see our presenters. Is it possible to go back to the presentation if the person is arriving late?
Sure.
Okay, is everybody okay with that? All right. Okay, we now have a public hearing. A public hearing is hereby declared open at 7:02 p.m. For the purpose of hearing public input on the district initial proposal to the Teacher Association of West Covina for 2013-14. Is there anyone who'd like to make a public comment? Okay, seeing none. There being no further comment, the public hearing is hereby declared closed at 7:03 p.m. Okay, I don't have a board president's report today. Anybody on the board? Mr. Cox? Ms. Poulos? Ms. Shoemaker? Okay. All right. Items from the floor. Is there anyone in the audience? I have no blue cards. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the board? Okay. There is no one in the audience that would like to address the board. We will go on to the business session. Okay. We were handed an amendment on item number 3. So we can move item number 3 with change as amended. So I'd like to pull that from consent so that we can...
You can just note it.
Okay, then let us note that item number 3, we have an amendment there. There's one change, so we can move it as amended. Is there anyone else who would like to add or subtract something from consent? Mr. Fox? Ms. Poulos?
No.
Ms. Shoemaker? Okay, then who will move to approve the agenda with item number 3, change as amended?
I will move that.
And who will second that? Okay, it has been moved by Ms. Cami Poulos and seconded by Jessica Shoemaker to approve the agenda and consent items with a change to item number 3. So we are going to move it as amended for the regular meeting of July 23rd, 2013. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Okay, it is carried 4-0 with one absence. Mr. Spence. Okay, let us move on to item number 5. Did anybody have any questions? I'll go one by one if you have questions. If there's no...
I
You do? Mr. Cox, did you have any questions? Okay. Ms. Shoemaker, was it the first item, BPE 1330? Okay, AR 3543, what page?
That is what I'm trying to find.
Oh, okay.
AR 3543.
Transportation, Safety, and Emergencies.
5I and J. Under electronic communication devices, the policy states a bus driver should not drive a school bus or student activity bus while using a wireless phone except under the following conditions. I would like to change that to a bus driver should not drive a school bus or student activity bus while using a wireless telephone, period. I don't want there to be any exception. I do not want bus drivers using telephones while they're driving our students. And then that also follows into the next page where it talks about texting while driving unless you're basically using hands-free. Again, our bus drivers should be focused on driving and what the students are doing in the bus rather than their phones, regardless of whether or not they're in their hands.
It's a vehicle code.
Okay. Dr. Coughlin, how?
The vehicle code allows it, right?
The vehicle code may allow it, but our board policy.
How do our bus drivers communicate with us?
If they need.
While driving? Because sometimes you radio in, where are you?
There's a radio. They'd pull over to the side of the road. They'd use the radio that way. Or they'd pull over to the side of the road, and if they have a device, but not while the bus is moving.
Okay.
So I think the intent of this is while the bus is in
motion.
Motion.
It doesn't specify, but I'm assuming it's their personal cell phone because we're not providing them with a
hands-free device. We don't provide them with a personal cell phone. So this
would be their personal because we don't provide them with a cell phone. We provide them with a radio.
That's correct. But almost everyone has their own personal cell phone, or they have GPS devices. They're not supposed to use those. They're not hands on the wheel. That's what it's supposed to be.
Okay. I would agree with you, Ms. Shoemaker. Because if there is a procedure that they have to communicate with base, then I would be concerned as well. Any other feedback, Ms. Poulos, Mr. Cox?
I have no problem with the recommendation. I just want to make sure that they never use their personnel, like if they were going to call 911, those kind of things. I mean, and they're not going to do it probably while they're driving, but how do they do that if we don't have cell phones for them? They radio it in for?
They can radio it in to the dispatch, or we do not provide them with a phone, but they can always radio in to dispatch.
And I would be fine if we have the exception under the following condition and leave number two.
Yeah, because the only one I could see is if you needed to call 911.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
And
I like that.
Well, and then when it says healthcare provider, do our bus drivers ever, like let's say someone's having a seizure on the bus, they would radio that in, correct? To our district office.
Well, they would assume that they would pull over to the side of the road, they would radio it in. They may call it in if they have their own phone, but they would call it in to dispatch, and then dispatch would call 911. No, they wouldn't.
Well, and I'm thinking when it says healthcare provider, I was thinking of maybe school nurse who was the case carrier for the particular child who had seizures. But you would still want to be pulled over, and if you were going to help
right.
that child.
Well, okay. Who would they have that information? Because it seems like the only people in an emergency situation you need to contact is law enforcement, the fire department, or some other emergency agency.
I don't know when they would.
Who would be the healthcare provider that you would be?
You know, they're going to call 911 if they're going to call anything. I think it's just the vehicle code, and they made it
okay, so we
broad
can take
to cover those emergency
healthcare provider.
Okay, so if they're supposed to pull over, they don't need a wireless device because they're not driving, because the law states if you're going to use a phone. So we can strike number one then.
Yeah, so it would basically be a bus driver shall not drive a school bus or student activity bus while using a wireless telephone except under the following condition. And all that would be left is number two.
Or just except for emergency, go right to that, except for emergency purposes.
Yeah.
And strike number three then, because yeah. For work-related purposes.
So do you want except for emergency purposes, or that whole sentence in number two?
Uh-huh.
You want to keep all
take
that?
Take out health provider.
But take out health care provider. And not as a list.
Correct. And then the next paragraph says, a bus driver shall not drive while using an electronic wireless communication device to write, send, or read a text-based communication, including but not limited to. And so I think that we should just take out the last sentence, which says this prohibition does not include reading, selecting, or entering a telephone number or name in an electronic device communication device for the purpose of making or receiving a telephone call, because they're not supposed to be making telephone calls.
Right. The only exception I would say to that is sometimes, because I know it's happened to me, I can't get through on a line, but I can get through on a text, and you can text 911. So if we, they can, right, like they can pull over. So I'm okay with saying they can.
But you also want to take out, you want to put the period at
yeah,
an
after
email.
Yeah, email.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Well, they would be pulling over anyway, so they can send a text. All right. Take this out. All right. Very good. Any comments on that, Ms. Poulos or Mr. Cox?
I'm fine with the changes.
Okay.
Let's go back to that item two again, please.
Okay.
How did you finally leave that?
Excuse me?
How was that finally left as far as that final wording?
So what's going to happen on number two, it's the sentence electronic communication devices. The bus driver shall not drive a school bus or student activity bus while using a wireless telephone except under the following condition. And then it's except.
For emergency purposes.
For emergency
except for emergency purposes. And then including but not limited to a call to law enforcement agency, fire department, or other emergency service agency or entity.
Just cross out health care provider.
I don't understand why we would leave that out. Why would we leave out health care provider?
Because they don't have access to that person.
Right. The only call they'd be making would be 911. I'm sorry? Or dispatch.
Do bus drivers have emergency cards on the bus?
No.
Even special education buses? So they wouldn't have access to them?
Yeah.
I mean, a healthcare provider, I don't know if anybody has the phone number to the fire department either. I think you just call 911. Mm-hmm. So.
I don't see reason to exclude it. This is, I guess, my point. Is there any reason to exclude it?
If
you don't have the number, they aren't going to call.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't help by excluding it. If they have the number, it gives another option to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Well, I'm okay with excluding it. Okay. I think we have consensus on excluding it.
And this is also our expectations of what the bus driver should be doing. Our expectation isn't for them to call the health care provider. Our expectation is that they're going to call 911 and get help to that individual as soon as possible. The more words there are in something, the more confusing it could be. So what I want them to do is call 911 and when somebody, uh-huh. You know, if there is a lawsuit, then they can say, yes, this person did exactly what they were supposed to do, because this person doesn't have access to that number. So even if they wanted to call the health care provider right away, they wouldn't be able to, because they don't have that information.
So should we add 911
well
in there, to your point, that
well because
that's
I
part
think
of our policy?
I think law enforcement agencies, fire department, or other emergency services are all going to be 911.
That's all 911.
Parentheses 911.
That's a good idea.
Why Why don't you just say call 911?
Right. That's what I'm asking.
That's my point.
But not limited to a call to 911, law enforcement, fire department. I do, by the way, have both of those numbers for West Covina only, though.
Okay. Add 911, comma, a law enforcement agency, comma, fire department or other emergency.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
911, law enforcement agency.
Nope, that was it. Anybody else have any other comments about any of the other ARs or the BP? Okay. Who will move this then?
I'll move it as amended for first reading.
And who will second it? Okay, Ms. Shoemaker. Okay, it has been moved by Ms. Poulos and seconded by Ms. Shoemaker to accept with amendments to AR 3543 for first reading the following board policy, administrative regulations, and exhibits as presented. BPE 1330, use of school facilities. AR 3543, transportation safety and emergencies with amendments. AR 4119.42, exposure control plan for bloodborne pathogens. Excuse me. AR 4119.43, universal precautions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? It carries 4 with 1 absence. Okay. We are now on to, I'm very excited about this, item number 6, implementation of the Common Core. I will turn this over to Ms. Kaplan. I'm sorry, whom is going to join?
Ms. Hopkins.
Okay.
Hopkins and Mrs. Valentine.
It's hard to hear with the air going. Sorry.
Well, and they had.
Oh, that coming down too.
Where do we start? I don't know if you saw the article in the paper about what many districts mm-hmm. are doing with the Common Core. It was just at a two-day workshop to talk about what we're doing nationally with the Common Core, and felt that it was really an appropriate time to meet with you and kind of share where the vision is for the Common Core and the Smarter Balance, where our district is, and some decisions that I think we need to make going forward in terms of the implementation. So we're going to start with Ms. Valentine giving us the history of how we got here with content standards and accountability.
I'm sorry, before you continue, is there a microphone there? Is it being recorded for the public? Oh, okay, thank you.
Good evening.
Hear that. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take you on a little trip through history. On the slide, you can see essentially 6 timelines. The one at the top starts in 1996 and continues past 2013 into the future. And I really want to focus on sort of 2 sort of eras, I think, of standards-based education and accountability. Back in 1996, California adopted its first set of content standards in English language arts. The next year, in 1997, adopted mathematics, and then each year after that, developed and adopted another subject area of content standards. Starting in about 1999 through the early 2000s, our district developed some of our first benchmark assessments in those areas through a process of constant revision and working with the standards. At the same time, we were developing pacing guides and refining pacing guides and adopted instructional materials that were aligned to the content standards. Our last significant revision to pacing guides and assessment was about 2009-2010. At that time, we knew that the Common Core was being developed, and we were sort of waiting for a little bit of direction from the state on that. And we do know going forward that the state has told us that no new frameworks will be developed until at least 2014. So during the period of time from that first adoption of language arts standards through really 2010-2011, the district underwent a continuous cycle of alignment of our benchmark assessments, our pacing guides, our materials to those content standards test and to the content standards. So really, a time period of about 14 years. Another significant event in terms of California education was in 1999 with the passage of the Public Schools Accountability Act. It was the PSSA that established API, the SARC, the whole STAR system of testing and reporting, and the CAISY exam. And those things, again, rolled out over quite a number of years. The initial API formula was based on the CAT-6, a norm reference test. Over the years, as the formula was recalculated each year, redeveloped each year, it then moved to an API formula that's based 100% on criterion reference test, or a standards-based test. During that same period of time, additional tests were developed. We started just with a test in language arts and math. Then over time, science tests were developed. History social science tests were developed. The CAISY was developed. The CAPA exam was developed. And most recently in 2009, the CMA was developed. Since then, no new tests have been developed, and our API formula has remained very, very much the same. And then one other, I think, big event that impacted education in California was NCLB, the Elementary and Secondary Schools Act, reauthorized under President Bush, NCLB. And sort of the big change in that accountability process was that we developed in California a federal measure and a state measure that had to be blended together. And that's where we started hearing about AYP, Adequate Yearly Progress, which was a combination of the API, AMO scores. It was a defining moment also in the way that we identify subgroups and measure the progress of subgroups. And this year, under the initial vision of NCLB, 100% of students were to meet the AMOs in English language arts and math. That would be all students, all subgroups, in all subject areas. And that era, when our test scores arrive in, I think, a couple of weeks, that era will essentially come to a close. Accountability measures in the future are a bit undefined. We know that there are proposals to change the API. We do not know what the federal accountability model might look like under a reauthorization of ESEA. But we know that the scores that we have this year will be the last time they're based on this formula with this combination of assessments. So it really is the end of an era, I think, in standards-based education. And the future in sort of the development of standards-based education is going to be seen in the development of the Common Core state standards. The Common Core state standards are unique in that it came from an initiative proposed by the Governors Association, and they decided that wouldn't it be of more value if all of the states of the United States had a common set of standards and that we were all working toward them, just like they do in some very high-performing countries, and that these standards needed to be developed with a global economy in mind, with the 21st century in mind. And so that initiative was supported by the Governors Association. They put together representatives from 48 states. They were educators, content specialists, advisory groups from many of the sort of college board type organizations. the National Council of Teachers, and some of representatives from councils like National Teachers of Mathematics, History, Social Science organizations. A number of individuals from California colleges and universities were on those development teams. And they did develop Common Core state standards for English language arts and literacy in history, social studies, science, and technical subjects. And those would be kindergarten through eighth grade. Additionally, there were college readiness standards adopted. That was a sort of a big shift. And the, as well as Common Core state standards for mathematics have been now adopted. Initially, the Common Core was sort of presented and published in 2010. California adopted them, indicated that they were going to go in that direction. In 2011, published the first California version. One of the agreements under Common Core is that a state may change up to 10% of the standards, and California did make some changes in their original adoption. Since then, they've made additional revisions, and just in March of this year, we received the most recent version of the California Common Core standards. One of the sort of complaints, I think, that people felt over the last era of standards-based education was that it took so long for everything to play out. Standards to be developed, tests to be developed, accountability measures to be developed. And that was a true criticism. It took, you know, 12 to 14 years to roll this out. So one of the goals of Common Core was to do it faster, and it has been going very fast. So the Common Core was adopted. And just about at the same time frame, two assessment consortiums developed, and the goal of these nationwide consortiums was to develop a testing system that could be used nationwide, that would be computer-based, that would test student progress in meeting these Common Core state standards. California originally joined a group called PARC, and then within a year decided that wasn't the way to go, moved over to the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium, and they have been working at an incredible speed to develop the blueprints for the test, all of what's called under each standard there are claims of what a student should be able to do, to develop all of those claims, to develop all of the actual items, and to develop the technology that this will all run on. So by 2011-12, they pretty much had the platform developed. They were developing items. Text specifications were made available. And this past spring, there was a research and a voluntary pilot, and some of our schools did participate in that to give us an idea of what this would look like. We were very curious and wanted to know, but also Smarter Balance wanted to gain a great deal of information from that experience. We are now sort of in a position of really getting ready for a very intensive implementation of Common Core state standards. That's what we've been working on over the past year, and our summer professional development focused 100% on that. We know that by next spring, 20% of schools in the state will be asked to pilot the Smarter Balance assessment. And there is the proposal that those students who are taking the Smarter Balance will not take a CST. We're also being told that what Smarter Balance is learning from these first initial assessments and research pilots is incredibly informative, and therefore, by the time we get to the operational version of these tests in 2015, it will probably look very different than what we're seeing right now. There have been some enormous advantages to rolling out both the Common Core state standards and the assessment at the same time. And I think the most obvious is that when you read a standard, it's words on paper. We try to interpret it and understand it as best as possible. When you see an item on an assessment that is written to that particular standard, it is a great model of exactly the expectation that we have for our students. And so as we've been doing professional development and teachers have the opportunity to look at these computer-based assessment items, it's been very informative in understanding exactly what we expect our students to do. Also, over the next probably 2 years, the state of California has already indicated that they are proposing significant changes to the API. For the last few years, we've been sort of very comfortable with the formula that's been used, 100% student test results on criterion reference test. Now up to 40% of it is being proposed that it measure other things, things like graduation rate, A to G completion rate. So some very different measures will be going into the API moving forward. And I think another change on the in the future is the system of measurement under Smarter Balance. In we're very accustomed to using a CRT test, Criterion Reference Test, or a California Standards Test. And a student's score is reported as a raw score and a scaled score. Under Smarter Balance, the matrix has not yet been set. We don't know exactly how it's going to be measured. If it will be measured as students making individual progress as measured for that student, we do know that it's a computer-adapted test. So as difficult or complex items come up before the student, if they answer them correctly, they will continue to get more challenging items on the test. If students get to a test item, they're not able to answer that item, then it adjusts to where the student seems to be able to perform. And in this way, this adaptive quality of the test makes it far more individualized. But then it's very hard to imagine how those scores will be reported out, and reported out in a way to indicate the overall program quality at a school. So it's going to be a very different matrix as we move forward. So as you can see in the last slide, what sort of took 14 years for us to accomplish in terms of state content-based standards education is being compressed into a very short period of time, 4 or 5 years, as we move toward the Common Core. So I admit our teachers are very eager. They're during the professional development this summer, the number one thing they asked for was just more time to work on it. We had some great conversations. We have great resources. One of the advantages of the Common Core is across the nation, educators are all working on the same thing. So we found tremendous resources from other states. And other states are doing much like we are, just trying to learn as much about it and prepare our teachers for it. But today I was working sort of on a summary of our professional development. And we had materials produced in Kansas, Massachusetts, New York, truly across the nation, great materials. I think we used a PowerPoint from Bozeman, Montana, and they're wonderful materials from our colleagues across the nation, and it really is, it's really a good feeling to know that we're all working toward the same high-quality standards nationwide. Okay. I do think I shared but I just want to make sure that in the development of the Common Core, one of the goals was that there would be fewer standards, but they would be more rigorous, and they would prepare students for college or career. There was, I think, a deep underlying sort of foundation in all of the high school level standards that they have to prepare students not just for a success in college, but for careers, because many of the careers are very demanding in what they expect students to do or new workers to do in terms of being able to read and manage technical information. We know that rigorous content and the application of that knowledge is going to be essential in the 21st century, and so all of the standards have been internationally benchmarked. And so I think that we're very much prepared. We've had 14 years of learning prior to the implementation of the Common Core, and what we have learned from those content standards has been incredibly beneficial as we go into a new era of standards that are far more performance-based. Okay. And now, Colleen. You reckon I'm one over you, huh?
That's okay. I'm gonna forward this ahead a little bit. These are some of the things that Mrs. Allentine talked about. And we're going to go ahead and talk about the shifts that we see with the Common Core, specifically right now in the area of literacy. You saw, you heard Mrs. Allentine mention the literacy piece. And so literacy will be a piece and a thread that you will see across all content areas. One nice thing with the Common Core state standards, they were really designed as a 12K rather than a K-12. Outlook to really prepare our students to be college and career ready. And in doing that, we need to take a look at these six shifts. So one of the major shifts that we're going to see is more balanced in the types of informational and literature sorts of texts that students read. Students will have in the elementary grades about a 50-50 split of the types of text that they'll be reading, working towards a 70-30 split by the time they graduate, so that they'll have 70% informational text and 30% narrative or literary text that they'll be reading. Another piece is that students will gain their knowledge of the world through text rather than exclusively through teacher lecture or through specific activities. They'll be encouraged to do a lot of wide and deep reading as we go through their academic career. A third shift will be a stair step of complexity. You can see here that we talk about students reading at a grade a central grade approximated text. There'll also be some texts that are preparatory at a little bit lower to prep the kids for some of the content, and then more challenge texts, or they call them texture texts, that kids will read as they become more proficient and to challenge their reading and thinking about the information that that they have in front of them. You see shift four is talks about text-based answers and text-based questions. This piece with the literacy development is key because this helps equal the playing field for all students. In the past, we've had a lot of building of background knowledge. You've probably heard of that. But students who have a wide array of different experiences come to text with a wide array of background knowledge, and they interact with that text very differently depending on their past experiences. By basing the questions and the answers that kids have within text, it gives all kids, our English learners, our low socioeconomic, even our GATE students, that sort of equal playing field to work from the text in answering their questions. It also gives them the resource to be able to support their answer or their claim or their argument by using the text rather than their personal experience to help support their understanding and their thinking and their assertions about what they're reading and learning. They'll be writing for everything, to explain and communicate, to work through, to summarize and express their understanding. And then finally, they'll be working more with a rich academic vocabulary. Teachers will be using that, and you can imagine if they're reading a 50% narrative and a 50% informational or expository text, the kinds of technical terms that they'll be coming in contact with will be a lot greater, and their vocabulary will be enriched from that. Before I go to the math, in addition, you'll see the literacy piece and literacy taught throughout the content areas. So no longer will literacy be refined or confined to the reading time or to the language arts or English classroom. You'll see it begin to be a lot of collaboration across the strand. So you'll see more writing in science, social studies, and math, as well as more reading instruction. Because I think we can all agree you read a technical manual for a college and career ready class very differently than you would a novel for your enjoyment. And sometimes we need those specialists to help with us with that teaching. In the shifts in mathematics,
question.
Yes.
Before you go into the math on the tech stuff, you said you're going. They're going from 50-50 to 70-30 and 70 to text-based.
70% informational expository text and 30% literary text. So by the time they graduate in 12th grade.
All right. So okay, I had that backwards.
Yeah, I was worried. I didn't make that clear.
Because it would seem that the text that the typical student is exposed to right now, not in school,
mm-hmm.
you know, the social medias, the internet exposés, or small tidbits. We're not talking major that. And you see that continuing and getting stronger?
A lot of informational text. It'll be informational. So
yeah.
Some of those informational things that you commented on, like blogs and things like that. But when you think of the kind of reading that we do every day in our careers or even in our personal lives outside of reading for enjoyment, most of that is informational pieces, reading technical manuals. And sometimes reading, you'll see a big change in the way people define text. Text isn't just the words on the page. It can also be the diagrams and pieces that they have to access. So think of just even watching a news report and all the different charts and diagrams that come in, reading a magazine article and all those different pieces. It'll be all of those. Any other questions? Thank you. The next one is with math. And the real shift that you'll see here with math, from what you might know from the current math standards, is there are two sets of standards. There are the content standards and the mathematical practice standards. The shifts focus a lot on the mathematical practice standards. So we have shift one, which is a focus in narrowing and deepening the scope of how time and energy is spent in the mathematics classroom. You may have heard the phrase, a mile wide and an inch deep for the kinds of mathematics that we teach in the United States versus other countries. You'll see within the content standards, they have a spread that shows how much more deeply we focus in the arithmetic and algebraic pieces early on, and then how we progress up through the levels, so that students have a deep understanding as they move to higher level mathematics throughout these new standards. There's also going to be more of a coherence, so teachers and principals and parents in the community will help the students to see the connections between those pieces. And I think they'll be much more clear to our community and to the people around them. This number three, though, that I really want to highlight is fluency. I've had the opportunity to be in education for almost 20 years and seen that pendulum shift from new math and constructivist math and back and forth. The really great thing about the Common Core has to do with the fact that fluency is still important. So when we teach a child to read, we encourage them to be a fluent reader, meaning that they can read it aloud orally, and it can make sense, and it can be smooth, and it can be fluid, and ready for them to work through any text so that they can gain the meaning. That fluency is the same thing here with mathematics. Students still need to have speed and accuracy and knowledge of basic arithmetic facts. So we aren't throwing multiplication out or addition and subtraction facts out with this new shift. But students will be working on more deeply understanding them so that they understand those connections when they move into higher level math and the numbers change to letters. And they have to start still computing, but they have to have a deeper deeper understanding. Shift five, then, is another one here. This one will be with the idea that students are to apply their learning, to actually do the math for real. So when they're working on their fluency, they'll do a lot of repetition and practice in isolation. But when they're also doing the math, they'll be doing that in a problem-solving way. And so that's where you see shift six in the dual intensity. Teachers and students will be working in both realms, trying to assist students and intervene in both areas. Because there are skills that come with problem solving and solving real world problems, but we all know how much we use math on a daily basis, that regular arithmetic, and depending on the college and career ready piece, a path that you take, the kinds of math that you'll use will be very different. So you'll need both of those skills going forward.
One of the conversations we had in all of our committees during the year of developing our strategic plan, in developing our strategic plan is we heard a lot about academic rigor, that the new standards are much more rigorous and that students are going to have to do more rigorous work. And that word was used over and over again. And so each of our committees had to really talk about what is academic rigor, and we needed to define it in a way that we all were using the same terminology. And we liked what we found from Robin Jackson that we felt really helped us understand what rigor was. So really, rigor is helping kids think for themselves, and there are four main components to it. The first thing is we want students to create their own meaning of what they're learning. It's not just the teacher to tell them what the facts are and for them to memorize it, but they have to create their own meaning. We want them to be able to organize information so they can create mental models. We're kind of doing that with thinking maps right now and how we're teaching kids to organize their thinking through the thinking maps. We want them to be able to integrate their individual skills into a whole set of processes. And most importantly, what you're going to hear over and over again is that students need to apply what they've learned to new and novel situations. And that is the biggest, I think, change in the standards, is the application of knowledge and being able to demonstrate what you know through the application of knowledge. So when we CBAC is the smarter balance, and we all know that you need to know what you're going to be tested on so we know how to teach, and that's kind of backwards planning. And what we're all trying to understand is what the CBAC or the smarter balance has and how it's going to be different and what impact it's going to have on teaching and learning. The one thing we've learned through Smarter Balance is that it really does support improving teaching and learning and what the application to the classroom. Through Smarter Balance, there's going to be a digital library for teachers to use where they can actually get questions, formative questions that they can use in their daily lessons to be able to determine what their kids know and what they understand so that they can change their lessons based on where kids are on a daily and weekly basis. The interim assessments, that's kind of like our benchmarks, that there are going to be banks of questions that teachers can access all over the country, teachers accessing the same banks of information. So when you're building these benchmarks or those interim assessments to really figure out where kids are and what kind of interventions we have, there will be banks of information for us. And then, of course, the summative assessment, the assessment they take at the end of the year, that uses as a benchmark of where they actually are at the end of each year so we can judge where we are as a school district. The one thing we hear a lot with Smarter Balance is cognitive demand, and that's the kind and level of thinking that's going to be required for students to actually engage in a task. So through the Smarter Balance, kids are going to be asked to do some problem solving in real-life situations, to apply knowledge and skills, to demonstrate their knowledge and skills, and the big change is this literacy across content areas, that they are going to be writing and reading across all content areas, which is going to be a major shift for our content teachers. A big piece that all districts are dealing with is the use of technology to demonstrate and apply knowledge, so we know that Smarter Balance is going to be taken using technology, but there's a whole bunch we need to do beforehand in terms of kids are not used to be thinking in technology. They're used to thinking with paper and pencil. So they're going to be, before they can answer these questions on the Smarter Balance, they need to have many opportunities in school to demonstrate their thinking through using technology. One is sharing what you know, but the other is really understanding how to use the technology to do that. And then, as Ellie already talked about, was the computer adaptive assessments, that these assessments are going to be very different. Students aren't going to be given all the same questions. And if they don't know higher level questions, they won't be frustrated by that, but the questions will really be tailored to where they are and what they're able to answer. And again, the goal that I'm hearing from Smarter Balance is really supposed to provide teachers with precise information so that they can build their instruction. But the instruction is going to be very, very different. So another concept that we had to deal with when we were writing our strategic plan is the difference between difficulty and complexity. And when we talk about rigor, some of the first initial definitions that came out is it's harder. If you ask kids what rigor means, it means that it's harder. But that is not the definition of rigor. It's more about complexity. So if you asked a class, how many of you know the definition of exaggerate, and everybody knew the answer, you would say that's easy. But if you asked them, how many of you know the definition of clairvoyant, and only a few kids knew it, you would say that that's a difficult question. That's not the way we're measuring knowledge anymore. We're really looking at complexity. And one of the things that we've been using in this district for a long period of time is Webb's depth of knowledge. And basically, this puts knowledge into three levels. So the first level we call basic recall. And if you look at some of the words, it's to draw, to identify, to list, to label. These are really very basic levels of complexity. The second one is skill and concepts, and that's when we're starting to talk to kids about classifying, separating, constructing. That's level two. When we get to level three, we're talking about strategic thinking, where we're asking them to solve non-routine problems, to explain phenomena, to hypothesize, to formulate. And the highest level is extended thinking, to design, connect, synthesize, apply different concepts. So, for example, if we look at level one kinds of questions, that's asking kids to list animals that survive by eating other animals, or identify elements of music using music terminology. If we go to level two, we're asking kids to explain the cause and effect of historical events, predict a logical outcome based on information and a reading selection. Well, currently, our assessments deal with level one and two. The majority of the questions kids are getting on the STAR testing is levels one and two, and basically we all know it's you know, eliminating information to kind of come up with the right information. But when we look at Smarter Balance, we are learning that in math, 49% are at level three questions, and in ELA, 43% are at level three, and 21% of the questions are going to be at level four, and 25% for ELA are going to be at level four. So 68 to 70% of the questions that kids are going to get on the Smarter Balance are at level three and four, where 100% of the questions that they were asked in our previous assessments were at level one and two. So when we talk about level three, solve a multiple-step problem and provide support with a mathematical explanation that justifies the answer using technology. Compare consumer actions and analyze how these actions impact the environment. Again, answering these questions using technology. And the level four kinds of questions are students are expected to make connections, relate ideas with the content or among content areas, and select or devise one approach among many alternatives on how the situation can be solved. We saw a math question in fourth grade where all of these expectations were in this problem where they were going on a field trip and they had to figure out the distance and which students in the class wanted to go on which student field trip and how many kids would fit on a bus. I mean, there were multiple levels to answering this question. Or they have to propose and evaluate solutions for an economic problem. So I think what I want you to walk away with this is we've been at level one and two. Our assessments are level one and two, so when we see kids are proficient, that's what we're expecting out of them. Now when we go to level three and four, that's what proficiency is going to look like for our kids. So our theme this year is transitioning to the Common Core, Mission Possible. That this is going to be a big transition for our district. And when I was in Chicago, I was given this visual that really helped me understand where we are and where we need to go. So we know on this side of the bridge right now, we have the content standards that our kids are used to using, our benchmarks, our pacing guides, everything is aligned to the STAR testing. And we have a really good, we've had a lot of success with this. Our scores have gone up, our students have been successful, and we're successful in this model. But now we're asking to cross the bridge in a very short period of time and move to performance standards that are going to be including these instructional shifts that we've talked to you about, and they're going to be aligned to the Smarter Balance assessment. And that's a big walk over a bridge. How are we going to do that? This is how we developed our strategic plan. We looked not only at the ELA and math standards, but we also looked at the science, the new generation science standards, and we looked at national standards for social studies. And we built our strategic plan on what we want kids to know and be able to do to make this leap. So we see the strategic plan as our transition to the Common Core. But we're going to have something going on right now. Our teachers right now are experts in the California content standards. If you go into classrooms right now, the instructional strategies you see, the things that you're seeing our teachers do, they're experts. They are now going to be novice, and they're going to be starting over because they're learning some major instructional shifts of how to instruct students. And so going from an expert in one set of circumstances, they're going to be novices, and it's going to take them time to go from novice to doing it mechanically, routinely, and expertly. That's going to take them time to get to the same level that they currently are. And when we talk about implementing the Common Core, We really want to do it with quality. We want to make sure there's fidelity, that from classroom to classroom, you're seeing the same kinds of things happening. It's not just happening in one classroom, but not another classroom. We want intensity, and we want consistency. So to get to that other side of the bridge is going to take a lot of staff development, training, and teachers being involved in this implementing the Common Core over a period of time. And what we know from research, that to get from the novice to the expert, to get to that kind of fidelity, it takes anywhere from 5 to 8 years. And the timeline that Ellie showed you is we don't have 5 to 8 years to get there. Transitioning to the Common Core is something that we've learned from McCrell is a second-order change. And when we talk about second-order change, it's really about a change. How does the magnitude of the change affect the people who are expecting to implement that change? So we know that this is a break in our current practice. We're going to be asking our teachers to do things very differently than they do right now, that they're moving from the content standards to the performance standards. And this is a big paradigm shift in terms of how achievement is going to be measured for our students. And that this change is very complex, and it requires new knowledge, new skills in the multiple areas. Our content science teachers and social study teachers are going to be expected to be teaching kids how to write, how to read, and that's not something that's been part of their curriculum. For our students to get over this, for our teachers and administrators to get over this bridge, they need to requires the new learning and knowledge, not just for our teachers, but for our principals, that we have to embed professional development. That means that we're developing our pacing guides, we're developing these things as we're teaching it, and that there needs to be collaboration in a school, both vertically and horizontally, but it also needs to be in a district from kindergarten up to 12th grade. For our students, again, they need to demonstrate new knowledge. They're going to have to demonstrate what they know, not just regurgitate it. There's going to be a strong emphasis on collaborating, communicating, creative thinking, problem solving. They need to use multiple forms of technology to demonstrate their knowledge, and they need to organize and exhibit their thinking through technology, kind of what I said before. One thing is to use the technology to show it, and one is to understand the technology to be able to use it, and performance is measured very differently. What we've also learned through research is that when a change of this magnitude is implemented, the first thing that you think is this myth that as soon as we change to the Common Core, our students and teachers are going to be performing at higher levels, that that's going to happen automatically. And what we see through research that that doesn't happen. As you're learning to implement these new standards and you're learning the new instructional strategies, there is going to be a dip in performance, both in teachers and in students. And Michael Fullen says, I think the lessons here is that this is normal when you're learning something new, and that is one of the reasons why a risk-taking mentality and a risk-taking climate is so important, because people won't try what they feel they're being judged prematurely on. So we're asking our teachers to take this leap of faith and to change what they're doing, but we need to provide an environment where they feel that they can do that and that they aren't going to be judged or punished for moving in this new direction. So the big thing, and the reason why we wanted to share this with you tonight, is I think we really need to manage expectations, and expectations of the board, expectations of the community, expectations of our teachers, that there will be an implementation dip, that we know right now that this is the last year we're going to be able to use the data that we currently use to look at students' performance, to really demonstrate where we are in terms of accountability. If second grade isn't tested next year, the scores are going to be very different that we get, and all of our school scores are going to go down, not because they did anything different, but just that second grade isn't going to be tested. The resources that are necessary to make this kind of change are still being developed. Teacher training is big. Textbooks and materials. I can't tell you how many emails I get a day of different vendors that are just throwing stuff out called Common Core, and to really be able to look at these things and determine, are they really good for us to use? The whole idea of technology for teaching and learning, we need to really see what we have. We need to add technology. We need to train teachers on how to use technology. We need to train the students, and then building the infrastructure that we need. And to really understand that the high-stakes testing that we're using right now, that it's not the testing that's going to be the future testing, and that we're going to go through that same kind of changes that we saw with the content standards. So I think the question for us, all of this is to bring a question to you, our board, because this is a very defining moment for our district. We're starting a new year. Do we continue our intense focus, time, and energy on implementing the California content standards, including our benchmarks, including our pacing guides. When we know the assessments, this data will not be effective in using the assessments going forward? Or do we put our time and energy right now on teaching to the Common Core, to putting in these new instructional strategies? We know by doing that, we really don't know what the impact is going to be on the accountability standards that we have this coming year. Some of our schools will be taking Smarter Balance, and they won't be using the California standards. Some of our schools will be taking the regular California assessments. The information we get back next year, we're not going to be able to use. So that's the question and the conversation we want to have with you today, because we'd like to start with our teachers on August 9th and give them a strong message of what we think is important for them to focus on, the kind of support we need to give them, and the expectations from our board.
Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and open it up to questions. Thank you so much. That was an excellent presentation. Ms. Shoemaker, questions?
I guess, Don, comments. Your question for me is number two, because how I see Common Core is giving you the deeper knowledge. So by moving forward and teaching to the Common Core, this effect that I see is that you will still have the understanding that you need for the CST, except it will be way more in depth. So it only makes sense to start with the more in-depth process.
Ms. Poulos, any questions or comments?
Well, I believe we should move forward on the Common Core with that understanding that we will see a setback, and that's hard. I'm wondering how our students did on, we piloted anything? Do we get anything back to know how our students did on those pilots?
No, we haven't. It was truly a research pilot, and then they allowed others to sort of join in if they wanted to try it out. And so we won't get information back on that. Smarter Balance will be using what they learn.
But they won't give us any information.
No, and I don't think the design of the pilot was to give us raw scores.
Okay. I think any information is, we could have tried to utilize it.
The information we got from the pilot really was eye-opening for our teachers and our students. To watch our students, many teachers came in and kind of observed the students taking it. Teachers had access to questions and really understanding how much more involved these questions are. So I think it was a tremendous learning experience for our district, not so much in terms of how our kids did, but what it's going to take to get
it. What it looks like to get it to actually the
process. And what we need to change in the classroom to help our students answer these kinds of questions.
The other question, and you addressed it somewhat, the use of technology, and the article was referenced that earlier in the TRIB about what we were doing, and I love the quote from you, but what we didn't address is how much more technology we need and what types of technology. When my little one left kindergarten, they told me they wanted her to work on keyboarding skills. So she had been using a desktop at school, and she knew how to use their mouse. So we used the desktop at my home. The mouse is completely different, and there was just a learning curve on the mouse. And then it wouldn't accept my desktop wouldn't accept the program that we tried to run to do keyboarding. So she had to do it on the laptop. That was a whole new experience. And then in the article, a lot of people were getting the iPads or the notebooks, which would be completely different. So if parents were trying to prepare their student and wanted to use the same type of technology that the school was going to purchase, do we have an idea what they're going to be using in the classroom so we can start letting parents know this would be the device that would be most appropriate to purchase for your child and to access the books online? Or, I'm sure we're going to be able to start accessing, parents are going to be able to start accessing some of the core curriculum things too to practice on. And then if my little one, before she came to me, had never touched a computer. So we're going to have some people, even with the knowledge, that are going to come with a different base of knowledge. So I know those are a lot of questions. I want to know what you're going to do with students that come in with no computer knowledge. What's the what we're selecting or what we're hoping to have for our students to take testing on, so parents can be prepared if they want to make an investment. And that you talked about remedial work, what that'll look like and how we're going to use technology for that remedial work.
I think we could do a whole evening on the technology piece, and I'm going to give you a couple of answers. I don't agree, and a lot of people don't agree with the keyboarding, because if you go anywhere in public and you watch kids on technology, very few of them are keyboarding. I think the kids have learned different ways. So I don't know that that is should be our focus, because I don't know that that will be the fluency that we need in terms of what kids are being able to perform. We're at a stage in our district right now is trying to identify what do we have in our district and what do we need to have in place by 2014 so we can take our assessments using the technology. And it might be a multitude. It might be some of them using laptops. It may be some of them using computer labs. The iPad 2, on my understanding, is the only iPad that you will be able to take the Smarter Balance on. So our goal this year is to really get us prepared for the assessment piece and identify the pieces we need to have in the classroom. We don't want to just say, we need technology, let's go buy iPads. We need this. We really need to say, what is it that we're expecting kids to do, and what device or many devices are going to be appropriate for that. So we don't have that answer, but that's part of the planning. But the major thing we have to identify is how we're going to have students take the test. I'm going to let Colleen talk a little bit, because they did implement technology, and the infrastructure piece is major in terms of what you have, and do you have the infrastructure to support it?
Right. I have the experience with the I3 grant in Corona Norco, and the grant involved purchasing 100 laptops for the teachers in that area and almost 900 laptop computers for the students. And we found that there were lots of things that we hadn't thought about. And so I think, as Mrs. Kaplan was saying, the idea of piloting this test has brought a lot of things to the forefront. Just how do we need to interact with the technology on a daily basis? Many, many infrastructure pieces need to be looked at. We're currently working on a wireless project. Michael Willingham and I were just talking about my experience in Corona, where the high school was built with two very large cinder block walls to make the walls, and the accessibility of that. Making sure that the IP addresses are available so that when people are on their wireless cell phone, you know how you have a wireless on your cell phone turned on, they don't get onto our computer guest system, which eats up the wireless addresses for our students. What is it going to look like when we need to have 60 or 70 students taking a test all at the same time, either accessing that wireless or all accessing the same site? So Michael and I have been talking about that and talking with other districts. We're assured, of course, that that will work perfectly from Smarter Balance, but we all know what that'll look like. And so I think that's a piece, too, that we're starting to think about and put in place. How we will test this year on our state assessments may look a little bit different as we prepare to be able to deal with 100% of students taking tests in a virtual environment. With your comment on keyboarding, I completely understand. We went through that as well. Teachers wanted to buy Mavis Beacon and do a lot of keyboarding instruction. What we found is there's so many different devices, and Ellie was sharing with me a study that we've done here in West Covina and we got access to. The device depends on the moment. If you're going to send a quick note to a student, to a family member, to anyone, you're probably going to text or email. You can do that on your phone. You can do that on a tablet. If you're going to type a long essay, probably not going to use your cell phone. May use a tablet, but I don't know if you've ever tried to use Mavis Beacon on a tablet, but it's impossible. You hover over everything that's wrong. And kids do touch screen. That advances so quickly. I even found myself using my tablet and going to my computer the other night, and I went to do something, and I thought, this doesn't work like that. But again, what kids really need is the opportunity to construct their thinking in a virtual environment. Right now, they construct their thinking in the environment we know, paper pencil, right? And when they go to that virtual environment, it's either at home for fun, it's some sort of communication device that they're doing, or it's for a final product. Right? Mm. It's very different to sit down to a computer and construct your essay, your argument, your short answer, than to type it from looking at it. We found more kids that, in my experience with the pilot, watching, sitting with fourth graders, more kids who struggled with the ability to get their real thoughts out in that virtual environment than it was the time they took. They get over 70 minutes in the test on some parts, and can be done in multiple sittings. That really wasn't the problem, the speed at which they typed. It was the ability to think about what I want to write, plan what I want to write, and then write it in that environment. So both of those are a hard one, and we don't know school like that.
And we will be bringing many reports back to you as we figure this out throughout the school year.
Ms. Poulos, any other comments or questions?
Those were my biggest, to get it started and looking at it, it's like, how do we make that work? Because all this seems great, and I understand, you know, that we'll drop a little, but actually the capacity, you know, do we have the capacity to do it, and we don't have the computers now to do it, and the computer lab at the high school, I'm sorry to say, is...
Well, it's little things, if you don't mind me adding. We learned just how do you distribute an image 900 computers when you buy them? So the answer isn't let's go buy computers for every student in the district, because just that was a huge process and cost and knowing what to do, and it gave me experiences I never thought I would get.
It's big. It's a big change on so many levels.
But it sounds like the teachers, for the most part, have bought in. And then these are going to be challenges not only we're facing, but the country as a whole will be facing these same, and then challenges. And will we have to do it paper and pencil to begin with, do you think?
We may have some. We may be using multiple forms. My goal would be to do as much on using technology as we can, because it's a learning experience for us as well. But there may be, you know, we have to look at each school and the capacity they have at each school and what we can provide for those schools right now. There may be some. I don't want to say that there won't be. I think when you said our teachers are eager, they are eager. But I think what they need to hear from the board, because we've been so focused on our accountability, and I think they're so afraid of letting go of what they know,
right,
and they're successful with what they know. And, you know, I'm going to ask, you know, you, Eileen, when you talk to the teachers on the 9th, I think they need to hear that we understand that this is a big change and we're going to support you in it, and we want to give you that environment in which you can grow. That's what they need to hear. They need to feel trust from all of us that we're going to allow them to learn in an environment where we're not going to judge them. You know, we're not saying we're throwing accountability out the window. We're not saying that, but the accountability is going to change.
And accountability is always a big piece. Just because of the funding mechanisms that are hooked to that accountability. So if we go paper pencil, how are they going to, a computer, you know, is going to be judging it the same way every time. But there's going to be a lot of bias when somebody grades it handwritten, and you know not the same person isn't going to read every one of our handwritten tests. Have they looked at that, and then the accountability portion of that, how that can hurt districts? Have they looked at how they're going to do that?
The last meeting I was at, we actually had one of the head people of Smarter Balance talk to us, and they feel that the paper pencil will be available for a few years to get people there. I think the thing that she stressed the most to us is what we see in the first iteration of the testing will be very different because of all of these things. So that whole measurement of accountability, they can't develop that kind of accountability with so many different variables of how we're doing it. I guess that's my best answer.
And then with that understanding, then I think going into it as a board, it's easy to tell our staff that we're on board with you, and even the country doesn't know what that accountability is going to look like. And we understand that.
Big piece.
May I share? I was in the high school professional development this summer. And the biggest question the high school teachers had, and we grouped all of language arts, history, social studies, and science together, and we approached it as literacy training. The biggest questions were not on use of technology. I think they have maybe more confidence in our students than we do to be able to learn new technologies quickly and move from tool to tool or device to device quickly. Their bigger concern was that their students would have, that they would have ample time, and their students would have ample time to practice. they'll be faced with on a test. For example, a student would be given perhaps three original source documents on a historical event from three different perspectives. And maybe, and these could be relatively short, maybe just a page each. But what the student is asked to do is to read each of those and then put information from all of them together and write a well-organized argument. And I think that's where we get into what Colleen was saying, that it's one thing for kids to be able to write and to have ideas about something. Mm-hmm. It's very different when you try to pull information from three texts, make an organized argument and point about that information that you perhaps have never seen before. So I think, though that is a very sort of typical thing we would expect of college-ready students, our students are not doing that frequently enough now to be able to go in and do that in a sitting and type it all in. I think that will be a challenge.
To add to what Ellie's saying, the fourth graders in the sample test that I saw had to read an article about brushing your teeth, a diagram and a science article about a tooth and its structure. There was something about cavities, and there was one other article, because I remember there were four that they had to scroll through. And then they had to write a letter to a friend who was afraid to go to the dentist and explain using those four sources, and those four sources had to be evident,
wow,
not cited, but evident that they used them, in the letter about why they shouldn't be afraid of going to the dentist. So when Ellie says that for a high school student, it's a fourth grader, 9-year-old, has to do that as well.
And so it's really being able to have the skill to really be able to rather quickly read deeply, extract information, turn it around, and then encode it into a new piece of work. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. For all of us.
In 70 minutes, you're right.
Yeah.
Can they be really short articles?
Okay, Mr. Cox, do you have any comments, questions?
Well, you mentioned that you've been doing this for 20 years.
Teaching.
And I've been sitting at this desk for 20 years, nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that pendulum truly go lots of different directions. Phonics and whole language. All of those different iterations of those kinds of things over the last 20 years. And so this, I just see this as being, okay, here we go again. You know, that system didn't fail per se, but it, you know, reached its end, and now we're going to start and go another way. You talked about math and learning math facts. One of the things I started doing with my granddaughter, who is learning math facts, is trying to teach her an alternative way to look at things using the associative properties or the distributive properties, which are way beyond anything that she could comprehend. But I can show you how to get to the same answer by going in a slightly different direction, you know, using those properties and those basic fundamentals. And she's no clue, but it is tremendous fun and challenge for me. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I'm seeing this, is I'm seeing, you know what, maybe we can move towards a more rigorous. I think that, quite honestly, I think that one of you said something to the effect that, you know, we've been wallowing down here in this sort of mediocrity of these CRTs and CSTs and this whole thing about, you know, wow, if I can only achieve to the 9th grade level, I can graduate from high school. Okay. And so hopefully, you know, we'll move beyond that. And we will draw people up. I think that the analysis of this bridge and then also this other diagram that you had in here, I thought was particularly good, showing the impact of going in, starting, hitting some roadblocks, hitting some, you know, setbacks, but overall, you know, the gradual hopefully will take us a little bit more on a geometric curve. Okay, so that. And then we're talking about the technology side of it and the things. And I attended a discussion this last summer, and the gentleman came out and put up this video. I don't know, probably everybody's seen it, but I thought it was particularly interesting. A video of a two-year-old, let's call him a two-year-old, I think it was younger, to be honest with you, who picked up a magazine, paper magazine, and went like that to try to, you know, to do it. And so here we're looking at, well, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to type this, that, and the other. Oh, no, there's a completely different level of this understanding, and also the idea of the foreign language type thing is that understanding that this is where we're going to be. So, yeah, to sit where we are, regardless of where we are with the test scores and that, is really not relevant. My teacher friends tell me, oh, you know, this is wonderful. You guys have done a phenomenal job of testing, you know, what are those Venn diagrams? So you're going to test this 10%. Attaboy, good job. But you got 90% that you haven't got a clue whether or not they've learned or not. So hopefully we'll get closer to doing that without being restricted in this whole testing environment as such. So, you know, maybe we'll do this another 20 years. Huh?
Hope so.
I'm very impressed by the presentation. I'm very impressed that we were able to land you, because to sit here and listen to the wealth of information that you achieved and the technology, I was sitting here going, wow, you were helping me to think about things I hadn't even thought about yet. And so we're very fortunate to have you join our team here. So thank you so much, Colleen. Thank you. Then it's a win-win then. I'm 100% in support of this. I absolutely am prepared. Anytime there's change, there has to be a learning curve. There has to be the ability to make mistakes. I want our teachers to feel that they are supported. And I think I've proven that over and over again from here. And I know we all feel that way. We want our teachers to feel supported. We want the best instruction for our students. And the sooner we implement it and the sooner we do it, then we're ahead of the curve. And I know I can cite an example that is before my time. My colleagues here will remember. We didn't fall off the cliff with the finances because we put in place safeguards long before. So we got pretty darn close, you know, but we didn't fall off the cliff, and other districts did, because we put in many safeguards early on, back when Mr. Cox and Ms. Poulos came on early on the board and Mr. Spence. So I'm 100% to say let's do it now, and I want to give the teachers that support, and I'd love to address them. And it sounds like I'm hearing from my colleagues on the board that I can address them at the welcome back to say we support you, we are behind you. We want you to do this, and we're not going to judge you. Instead, we're going to say, how can we do this together and learn? And because this is going to, it's going to improve for everyone. I'm excited. I am so excited. I have a question that I can ask offline, but thank you. Thank you so much. This was really good, and the visuals were good, too. I agree with Mr. Fox. Okay, can we take just a 5-minute break before we go on to item 15?